it's not rat race or work versus having fun. It's all under the same umbrella. You can find purpose in your professional life within a micro role, within the macro, you know, premise of your whole, whatever it is your particular industry is doing, in the same way that going out and going, you know, for a long run or climbing a mountain or flying a plane or playing guitar or marrying someone or having children, it's the same thing.
And that is Sebastian Terry, founder of 100 Things and Kind Some. And you're listening to the Sam Gash Podcast. In this series of conversations, I chat with peak performing humans who have ventured boldly into the unknown. We definitely skip over their highlights reel and we just go into the guts of who they are and what they believe in. This week, I am really excited to be sharing with you two podcasts, this one here with Seb, and later this week, I'll be releasing one with Nick Butter. I initially planned to release these episodes probably about a month apart, as I thought that their stories were based on a similar premise, both worthy of being shared, but maybe some space in between, maybe to make the conversation seem a little fresher for the audience. Superficially, I thought these were stories about how someone chooses to move past grief and find meaning in their life. And that was until I spoke to them. I definitely believe that these conversations intertwine beautifully, but are also very contrasting. They're conversations about permission, choice, growth, and connection. These two gentlemen certainly shine a light on that pursuit of happiness. Both gentlemen ticked off huge goals, but I think it's fair to say that neither believe that happiness is created upon the achievement of a goal. Rather, it comes from the act of making progress towards that goal, and therefore happiness is a function of personal growth. In a time of adversity, I really believe a growth mindset has never been more vital. And both of these two guys are, you know, are shining beacons for that growth mindset. They choose to highlight the power of curiosity, self-improvement, the capacity to demonstrate self-awareness and compassion, and change to their world, which also benefit others around them. Both Seb and Nick are at different points of their journey, and I won't go too much because obviously the conversation will go plenty into it, but I do think it's beautiful to hear these one after another. So let me introduce you to Seb Terry, because about 11 years ago, he experienced a life-changing moment when a close friend of his passed away, and it forced him to ask a very critical question: am I happy? The answer was no, and so we decided to put a list together of 100 things that he wanted to achieve, as he believed this would be something that could enable him to be happy. On this list is high adventure, from endurance tandem bike riding, featuring in a Bollywood movie, going to the Playboy Mansion, marrying a stranger in Vegas. It also includes like living with a tribe for 1 week, being silent in the city of New York for 1 week, throwing a dart at a dartboard, which is a map of the world, and going to wherever that country was. It's an insane list, and I certainly, you know, encourage you to check it out as we're having this conversation. His story started as one of an entertaining tale of adventure, and it's definitely transformed into a global philanthropic movement that engages a very connective tribe of people to set meaningful goals. And it's really interesting to see how this has played out over the last 10 years. And I've been following Seb for 10 years through his work as a corporate speaker, through his book, which is a bestseller called 100 Things. He was on a Discovery Channel documentary called 100 Things to Do Before You Die. And most recently, there was a US-based reality TV show called 100 Things, where Seb travels the world helping complete strangers achieve their specific dreams. His website has links to his podcast, to workshops, to enable people to be able to create their list. There's a lot that we talk about in this conversation, and it's such a pleasure. Without further ado, let's kick into it. By way of disclosure, this conversation for a brief moment mentions the murder of a baby. Both parents are serving time for that crime. Thanks for jumping on the podcast. It's we were trying to correspond with our times for this podcast, and I said to you, so where are you based? And you're like, Venice. And I'm like, okay, Venice, Italy. I'm going to kind of check the time zone difference, and it was not many great times with Melbourne. And then I sent across some suggested times, and you were quite confused because you don't live in Venice, Italy.
No, I'm in the other Venice in LA, which is very similar, just a lot more homeless people. And But the times are different too. But we made it, which is great.
I know. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but I feel like I entered into the corporate speaking space not maybe like a season after you.
Okay.
And for those who don't know corporate speaking, like often as a speaker, you'll hit up an industry and you'll really kind of like penetrate that industry before you maybe move on to the next one. So I think you did a lot in the financial advisory space.
Mm.
And I rocked up there afterwards and everyone was raving about you. And I would say like 99% very positive. And then there was this 1% of, you know, human who'd be like, I just don't get why he spoke with bare feet.
Yeah, I do get that a little bit. I do get that a little bit. And to those 1%, I say, how are you? And thank you for the support.
I mean, I have to ask, why do you do your speaking engagements bare feet?
Well, there was a time I didn't wear shoes at all for kind of recently for 2.5 years. But the first time I ever spoke was in England, and I wasn't, you know, by any means a speaker. I just got invited to speak at a travel show, and I thought, how do I kind of encapsulate my message on stage? I thought, oh, I'll tick something from my list. So I ended up, long story short, breaking the Guinness World Record for the most amount of eggs crushed with the big toes in 30 seconds. On stage at the end. I got it, by the way. I have the certificate. It's ridiculous. But I didn't wear shoes for the talk, and I just really enjoyed it. And I, you know, and I'm also from the beaches in Sydney, and so it was sort of like comfortable for me. So I just, I just didn't like it. I just didn't like wearing shoes, so I don't. And that's it. Everyone's like, oh, what's the meaning? What's the meaning behind that? Are you grounding? Are you spiritually centering? And I'm like, no, just feels good.
Just. Yeah. It's so funny because I love it how that became a talking point for you that you didn't wear shoes. Mm. And myself as a female, I often got critiqued when I wore a dress that had too loud a colour, and then people thought that it was appropriate to spend, you know, the majority of their time making assessments of me based on the colour of clothing that I would wear on stage.
It's funny, isn't it? I think as people, we're just like, you know, and me included, but, you know, we're quite simple creatures, and I just feel like any difference is something that allows us to pigeonhole. And if we're able to label something, it's easier for us to just do it, you know, without actually understanding the reason why you wore a colourful dress or why this person doesn't wear shoes. So, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, yeah. I'm into nude podcasting at the moment. You've got to try it. It's phenomenal. I'm assuming you are, actually.
I'm nude and you're nude. We should have done it with a video.
I actually, back to the foot thing, foot thing, it sounds creepy. I've had a couple of events where the client has asked me to wear shoes. And of course, you know, if I absolutely have to, I will. But I always ask why, and, you know, why is that? And in Australia, there's a lot of, you know, OH&S type stuff. So I sort of understand it from a, yes, you know, a crossing the T's, dotting the I's point of view. But yeah, it's there was. I remember there was actually a time in the US. So I'm based over here now, and where the client asked me to wear shoes. And I said, yeah, sure, absolutely, you know, but why? And it seemed like they couldn't really answer it. And again, long story short, my agent over here ended up having to call. They called my agent for the agent to call me to convince me to wear shoes, and it became an absolute circus. And it was fine. I did wear shoes, and I don't have a problem with that at all. Just to dispel any rumours that I've just started that I'm a nightmare to work with.
you're a nudist speaker that's not going to also wear shoes.
Absolutely.
Everyone, go book Sebastian Terry.
Yeah, in fact, I will only wear shoes and nothing else from this point on.
Well, talking about your list, and, you know, I am going to speak about your list, even though I now know it's been a decade since you've written it, and the evolution is kind of almost beyond the list now, but I feel like it's the grounding and it's the kind of foundation of where you've begun in this part of your journey. So, you know, can you give the people who are listening to this podcast this understanding about like your 100 things and kind of where it started?
Yeah, sure. So I have a list of 100 things that when I put it together, it was designed, you know, with the hope that it would bring me closer to a sense of, you know, happiness or fulfillment, whatever those words are. And it was prompted by a few things. One was I had a degree, and I remember at graduation getting this degree, which I was told I needed. And at the end, I just felt really underwhelmed. And then I went backpacking overseas as a way of, I don't know, just trying to avoid a reality, I guess. And whilst I was overseas, I lost a friend of mine back home in Sydney. And the news rocked the whole community where we're from, Avalon and the Northern Beaches. And that made me, I guess, question life and how I was living it. And, you know, I was kind of inspired by the way Chris, my friend who had passed, had lived his life. And I just realized that I was kind of unhappy, really. So that was the beginning of a list. I just said, well, what would I do to try and be happier? So I created this list. And then sort of, you know, again, condensing along the story, but I started a business and it was an events company. I forgot about my list because I thought, no, you know, you've got to conform. And I was just grossly unhappy. And, you know, all those three events, although they happened separately, all kind of culminated at one point for me. And I remember breaking down back of the taxi emotionally. The taxi didn't break down. And then I was just like, wow, what does this mean? So, and I kind of got my list out of my drawer, which had been in there for a few years at this point, and I'd forgotten about it. And I looked at it and I just said, that's it, I'm going to do this. So I left with no plan, barely any money. And you know, like you say, we're almost 11 years on now, and it's turned from a story about a guy and a list into this big community. And of course, kindness is something which runs throughout it now, and it's really lovely.
It is actually amazing, and I've watched a lot of videos. I've read a lot of the stories of the things on your list, and there's a couple that, you know, intrigue me on a personal level. But what I liked about your story is, although it would be very easy for it to be this kind of constant tribute to your friend that passed away, and obviously there's origins in that, it was more of a response for yourself of how do I make sure that I live a life that I am happy with. And I think sometimes when people do things as a catalyst from something tragic that's happened to somebody else, that's always that driving and connecting force. And I do respect that you've kind of turned it into something for you. And do you know, have you heard of Bronnie Ware, that Australian palliative care nurse?
I've just been writing some stuff on the five regrets of a dying person, right?
Yeah, because it's the first thing I thought, like the number one regret that people have on their deathbed. And Bronnie Ware was an Australian palliative care nurse, and she looked after patients in their final 12 weeks of life. And her number one regret that she kind of recorded from people was, I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life that others expected of me. And I remember when I read that and I was blown away. And when you kind of decided to let go of that events company that you found yourself funneling your time into because that was the appropriate thing to do, how hard was it to just go, I'm going to begin this like fulfillment of these 100 things that I wrote down, you know, a little while back?
Yeah, incredibly easy, ultimately. As opposed to a standard answer that it was tough and I wasn't in a great place. I wasn't depressed. I just wasn't stoked on life. And I remember getting out this list that I had previously drawn up, and I looked at it and I remember thinking specifically, like, I'm a capable person. We all are, right? And I was just putting all my energy into this business, and, you know, it wasn't making much money. In fact, you know, I had none, but it was kind of working still. And I thought, imagine if I just put all this energy, the same energy that I'm putting, you know, 20 hours a day, just to exaggerate a point, it wasn't 20 hours a day, but it was all day, every day.
A lot of work.
It was a lot of work. I'm serious. It was. And then I thought, if I put this much energy and time and resource into not my business, but this list, which is now on my wall, oh, I'm going to be happy. And as soon as I realized that, and it was 1 second, you know, a moment of just thinking about it. I booked a trip overseas. I told my best mate, my business partner, hey, as soon as we pay this company off, I'm out of here. I've got to do this list. And that was it. So it was actually, although the ramifications of what it was seemingly quite large, internally it was the easiest thing I've ever decided once I realized that that was actually how I thought I could become happy.
Okay, a couple of like construction questions. The first one is like, how long did it take to like put the list together, and was there a certain strategy, or did you just kind of like scroll just like thoughts and just they all kind of formed?
So with me, well, this is the irony of it all, because I, you know, like you in the corporate field, I do a lot of workshops around list creation, etc. And so I teach it in a different way that I, the way I did it. But for me, it was just a shotgun approach. I was in that in a moment. I was in Canada when I got that phone call about my friend. And I remember just starting to write down things. Just, we all have them, those things that are in the recesses of our mind that we don't really think about, or we do at one point and then forget about it because it's, you know, not seemingly cool to, not cool, but it's not expected. We're not encouraged to do the things that just make us smile. We're encouraged to go and get the degree and then get a career and et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I just kind of started like picking these things out of these dark areas of my mind and these forgotten areas. And yeah, these things just flooded onto a bit of paper. And as soon as you give yourself permission to start doing that, it just creates this amazing, like a snowball effect, really. And I was like, oh, that's right. I want to jump out of a plane naked. I remember thinking that and forgetting about, oh, that's right. I want to complete an endurance. Oh, that's right. I want to live on a deserted island. And then you start fascinating about it. And it's intoxicating. And then you start talking to people about it. And then people hear about it. And they say, hey, we heard you're doing a list. This is what's on my list. And you're like, oh, that's an amazing thing. I'm going to put that on my list. And you start sharing. And, you know, that's how we should be living. We should be inspiring each other and helping build each other up. And unfortunately, it's not really what happened. So the construction of the list was in fact, again, really easy once I chose to do it.
You've got number one on your list. And for those who are intrigued to see what Seb's list is, you can find it at 100things.com/Sebastian list. And number one is running with the bulls. And is there some kind of like chronology of importance in that list, or is it just wherever they lay is where they lay?
No, and I'll also just say this quickly too. When I put running on the bulls on there, running with the bulls, it's of course like an adrenaline thrill, this thing that happens in Pamplona in Spain, a very traditional this, that, and the other. But it's actually really cruel to the bulls, as I found out. And so I wouldn't sort of recommend doing that. But it was number one for no reason. It just happened to be the first thing that spilled out. So it's in no order. You know, I've done number one and seven and 17 and 84 and all that. So and what I found obviously is they just pop up at different times. You can plan for some, but other things just pop up and you've got to go with it.
Well, yeah. And I think let's just like say it, this list was written over a decade ago. So, you know, I think, you know, what might have intrigued you and have seemed really important back then, in a place when you weren't particularly happy and maybe knew where you wanted to be, I can imagine it would be a bit different if you wrote that list today. Is that right?
Oh, for sure. And I, it's a really important point you make. And I think it's, I'll just say it just in my head, you didn't ask, but I think it's because of values. I think that values change, right? You know, yeah. And I think, of course, I'm very different to how I was 10 years ago. And so are you. And so is the person listening now. And you'll be different in 10 years too. And if our meaningful list, I believe, is based on an understanding of our values. So everything that we do should be based on values. And as those values change, of course, the things that we do change and our goals and aspirations change. So, yeah, there are certainly things that back then I was very much after adventure and liberation and the craziness and the breaking the shackles. And now it's not so much like that. I really enjoy the connection, the being of service and, you know, helping and all that sort of stuff. Not to say, by the way, that it isn't still scattered with a few weird and wonderful personal things, because I think that the idea of, you know, there's this, I'm kind of going everywhere here, so you're going to have to just stop me, Sam, when I don't make sense.
No, it makes sense.
I think there's this idea that, so the story arc with my journey is I talk about this analogy of the oxygen mask. You go onto a plane, you put your oxygen mask on first. That's what they tell you. And once you're looked after, you can then help others. And so I definitely absolutely believe that you need to be selfish or self-centered might be the better term so that you can be of service to others, whether it's personally or professionally, et cetera. But then, you know, a lot of people now sort of look at my journey and they're like, oh, you're the guy who helps everyone. And I do. I help as many people as I can. But it's not to say you can't look after yourself still. It's spinning plates. You've got to consistently be, you know, in an environment where you're gunning for your own goals. And by doing so, you find yourself able to help other people with their goals too. And if you're in an ecosystem or a community or a family or a friendship group where everyone's got their own goals, you'll find that not only will everyone be achieving their goals, but they'll be able to fire off each other and help each other out too.
I 100% agree with it, to not reference 100 things any more than I can possibly do so. But I think I went through a really similar experience as well. Like, you know, I don't know if you know much of my backdrop, but I came from someone who never did sport, was probably really, really unsure of myself, was working in corporate law and needed adventure to kind of explore who I was as a person. So did like these radical adventurous things. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of hit this point where I was like, all of this adventure is incredible, but if it doesn't mean something beyond myself, it's why do I keep doing it? Mm-hmm. And I can see this like list right now. It's like littered with like kiss a celebrity and skydive naked and scooter across Australia, and one you haven't marked off, which I can help you with, cross a desert.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things in this list that are high adrenaline, but of course there's also, you know, things like, you know, publish a book and help a stranger. And one that I have to ask you about from a personal thing is visit a death row inmate.
Oh, yeah.
And this is just, I personally want to know this because I worked on a death row campaign. I moved to Texas for 3 months. I worked in the mitigation phase of an inmate who had been on death row for quite a long period of time. And so I'd love to know, like, one, why is it on your list? Two, you know, how did you even get an opportunity to go there to meet this person, and what was that like?
Yeah, so I, by the way, amazing that you've done that work. I'd love to know more about that. I mean, my list, well, I was kind of sheltered growing up, and so I wanted to get out of my comfort zone to experience different things, you know. So I had never been around anyone in a jail or, you know, criminal as far as I was aware. So I thought, well, I'd love to talk to a criminal. Where can I find them? All right, in a prison. So I was like, I want to talk to a criminal in a prison. And then I just sort of thought, well, what would be like the most, you know, exaggerated form of that? And I thought, geez, someone on death row. So people laugh at this because you probably get it too, I bet, when you do something that's, you know, incredible, like you just have with all the money you raised for the fires in Australia and stuff. Did a lot of people say to you, hey, how did you do that? Was that kind of a common question?
Yeah, it was. It definitely was. And I'm kind of understanding you. It's a simple step, yeah.
So I went to Google when I Googled death row pen pals and was met with a database of thousands of people on death row. And they each had a little bio and they each had an address. So I read through, you know, like hundreds of these bios to try and find someone who, I don't know, for whatever reason, stood out. And I found this guy called James Mitchell III, or J-Lock. And he had a story there and I saw his address. So I just wrote him a handwritten letter and I sent it to him. And I was in Australia then. And we ended up communicating via written letter, maybe like one or two letters a month for a year. And at the end of this period, he invited me. He's like, he was in Oklahoma, in McAllister. And he said, if you want, you can come visit me. And I said, I do want. So even the letter exchange was hilarious. At one point, he was flirting with me. And he said, you know, I can't wait to kiss you. And I had to say, I wrote to him. It's not like a message where I can just text him immediately. So I had to write him a letter and go, mate, I'm not sure what you think here, but I'm not gay. And he wrote back and he was like, oh, dude, I'm so sorry. I thought you was a chick. And anyway, that was quite funny. So I ended up, yeah, that was it. He invited me in. He put me on a guest list, so to speak. And I went to this penitentiary in McAllister, this tiny town in the middle of nowhere in Oklahoma. And I mean, the whole experience was absolutely insane. From, you know, driving up to this fortress of a prison that had barbed wire all around the top of it. And I, from a distance, it was sort of on the top of a hill, just glistening in the sun. It was a boiling day. And I get in there, but I had to relinquish all my items, had to take my belt off, I couldn't have anything but bare clothes on me. And then I ended up walking through like three or four like massive doors that shut behind me as I walked through them. And then I ended up three levels downstairs and in this kind of, you might have seen it on a movie when you're in a room and on the right hand side there were three stools with three windows in front of them, and on the left there was three stools with a window in front of each of them and a telephone as well on each of the walls. And I just went up to like window number two, I think it was, on the right hand side, and there was just like a glass, you know, there was glass separating me from this little room, and it was empty when I got there. And I just sat down, there's a red telephone next to me, and then suddenly J-Lock walks in. And he puts his fist up against the window, and we sort of fist pumped through this very thick reinforced glass, and we picked up the phone, and I was there for 5.5 hours chatting to him.
Wow.
Yeah.
What'd you talk about?
Everything. Well, he spoke about absolutely everything. You know, life, and he was very well. It was just so funny. He started sending me or showing me. He like went out and went and got some stuff, and he came back and started showing me photos of girls who he'd been like chatting with over his time in death row. And he's like, this is my baby, this is my girlfriend, this is this one here, she's cheeky, you know, and there was just a procession of women. I felt jealous. And then, like, he got served food at one point. So it was like a trolley that was going, like, on the door which he entered from his side. Behind that door, there was a trolley, and he went out through the door, got this food, and explained to me the food. And Like, this is just horrible food. Everything was amazing. And then we started talking about his life, and he wanted to know a lot about me. So I told him everything, sort of like an unofficial podcast, really. He's interviewing me. And then, he sort of went through the crime that he denies committing. It got pretty serious, yeah.
I mean, you're sitting with this guy who's telling you he's innocent. He's explaining his version of events.
Mm.
Did you feel the, I mean, it's hard to ask the question, like, did you believe him with what he was saying?
It's tough. I don't know. I don't know if he did this. It's the actual case, there was a baby that got killed, either severe shaking or a blow to the head, right? And it could have been, it was his girlfriend's baby, and it was either him or her. It was like a whodunit, and they actually both got punished. So he was on death row, and she was serving life in a penitentiary with no, I can't remember the terminology, but she couldn't get off, no parole.
So she's life imprisonment without parole.
I think
so. She can't get out, but she's not on death row.
She wasn't on death row, but they both got punished for the same crime, and it was only one of them because they had counter stories. It was her, it was him. So I guess kind of to fill you in on what happened, he's now off death row. He's in prison still, no parole, maximum security. He's got a Facebook account and all this sort of stuff. But as we were chatting, so, you know, he said it was her, and the story he told me made sense, and I'm sure if she was to say her story, that would make sense too. But he was telling me things in there that were pretty bad, and so not that I necessarily believe in not that I believe people should get killed, by the way, as a punishment, but he did some pretty grim stuff that does require some kind of punishment. So, whatever the term is for that. So, I don't know. I just know that he was a pretty shady character. In fact, the first message he sent me a message on Facebook. This is years later, and I was in Manly, where I was living in Sydney, and I got this Facebook message, and I was like, what? Is this just – because I get kind of quite a few weird emails sometimes from people pretending to be different people. And I said – I replied, and I was like, J-Lock, is this you? What? How come you've got a Facebook account? And he's like, oh, I got out of death row. I'm now on blah, blah, blah. Here's my phone number. Give me a call. So I was having breakfast in Manly, and it was like a nice summer's day, and I rang him. And straight away he picked up, and we had a chat. And it was all a bit weird, and then I realized, oh, my God, this guy's got my number suddenly. And since I'd actually met him, we continued chatting. I got his mum a present that he asked me to get his mum whilst he was in death row, like a pendant for her birthday and stuff. But then I saw he put his first Facebook post was something like, when you're shooting at an enemy, make sure you shoot in the head. Something really bad like that. And I thought, yeah. Okay, I don't know about this guy. So, I did what, you know, is extremely offensive now in life, and I unfriended him.
I mean, but that's the thing. You were looking for human experience of people that you just would not probably encounter in your normal life. And sometimes after doing that, you're like, no, it's probably a good thing for me to not encounter you again.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think so. It was, you know, I think for what it was unbelievable. You know, I really could talk for hours about, I could talk for a long time about that. And I think it was, I think it was something he'd probably remember too, because it was, you know, so many stories. There was a lady next to, I met this lady walking into there, not to make this whole podcast about this experience, but I met this lady as we were like giving our wallets and stuff away. And I said, she was like, oh, who are you here to see? And I go, James, I don't know him, blah, 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 blah. And I said, who are you here to see? And she's like, my husband. So I was like, oh, my gosh, wow, okay. I sort of come from a sheltered background, so I couldn't really work out why was he in there? And I was like, oh, I'm sorry to hear that, I don't know any context. And then she goes, this is the last time I'm going to see him. He gets killed tomorrow. And I was like, what? So we end up walking. I'm at stool two, remember? She goes to stool three. So she sat next to me. And J-Lock, as I'm talking to him, goes, that guy next to me, he's getting killed tomorrow. And I was like, oh, my God. And I go, what did he do? And he said, oh, he's done everything. He admits it. He doesn't care. And I was like, and his wife's here? And he goes, yeah, they've never met. She's just written him, like you, to me. They just got married over written letter. It's crazy.
I never understood the fascination, because this is like a common practice, you know, people in death row, end up marrying people on the outside. And yeah. I'm just wondering what it is for these, you know, women or men who choose to form a relationship with someone who's on death row. Like, what is that? Like, why?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think you'd probably have to be a psychologist to give a proper answer. Yeah, but
Which neither of us are.
No. Although I've been watching a lot of Instagram Live recently and everyone else is. It's incredible. I think it's got something to do with, you know, like being lonely. I think it's a real, you know, obviously it's spoken about a lot. It's a real pandemic in our world, aside to Corona right now, loneliness. And I think people are looking to connect in any way. And if you don't have anyone next to you and you don't have your friends or a social circle or any of that sort of stuff, you'll look for it anywhere. And, you know, if you see a guy who's willing to write to you every day or whatever, or a girl, who's on death row, you probably consider it. I don't know. It's a strange world out there. And again, going back to the list, that's what I want to see. It was a pleasure to be able to experience that.
Before you went and kind of started to embark on the list, were you feeling lonely?
I felt lost. I felt really lost. I just, you know, I'm an upbeat character and I, you know, I wasn't singing in the shower and I had no money, but not that was really important, but just no aspiration or hope or goals, or I didn't know who I was. So yeah, like internally I was lonely. I mean, thankfully, you know, I used to play a lot of rugby and I've always been around people and I've got really good friends and, you know, and all that sort of stuff. So no, it wasn't like, it wasn't that I was lonely. It wasn't that I was depressed. It wasn't any of that stuff. I think it was something, though, that was just as, you know, influential, and that was I had no idea who I was. So that's what it was. Yeah. That was kind of the reason I just wanted to try and, not to sound too, spiritual, but like I just wanted to try and see if I could get closer to working out who I was.
Well, yeah, and I think by doing it, like variety of things in spaces that you have no experience in, it's certainly going to tap into you understanding like your default settings, you know, strengths and weaknesses. Who do you connect with? What are you excited by? Which, you know, I feel like we're fools to be walking through life and not to be excited by the day.
Yeah.
Because we only have one life. Like let's make it in a way that we feel fulfilled. I read an article where at some point during your journey, someone offered you like this blank check to be able to live out all the things on the list. Like, how did that play out?
So his name was Tyson. Basically, I was doing a week of silence in New York and it wasn't like a meditative one. I just decided to be silent for 7 days. It was on my list and I thought, oh, it'd be really fun doing that in Manhattan. And it was, and it was weird and it was hard. It was actually one of the harder items on my list. And coincidentally, on day one, I walked out of the door. I was 5 minutes out of the door and I bumped into a guy called Paulie, who I used to play rugby with in Sydney. And he went, oh my God, I haven't seen you in years. What's been happening? And I had to write down on a bit of paper, mate, so good to see you. I can't talk to you for a week. So he found that hilarious. He dragged me into a bar. It turned out that he was a professional sailor. He was going to have a meeting with his crew. All sailing meetings happen in bars, it turns out. And I went into this bar and there was like six or seven people there, including Tyson, the owner of this boat, a very wealthy individual. I couldn't talk. He thought I was odd, as you would. Paulie was kind of my mouthpiece and told him everything. You know, oh, Seb's doing this. He's got this list of 100 things. And this guy, Tyson, was sort of fascinated. And I left. And I guess it was like a week later, he emailed me and said, Seb, I've looked at your list. I've spoken to Paulie about this. And I want to help. I just think it's so admirable. He said in a really humble way, I've got all the things in the world. Materialistically, I've got money, I've got, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I don't have what you have. And that's the ability to throw yourself at things with passion. And he said, I would love to help you by giving you a blank check. How much money do you need to achieve everything on your list? And this was on an email. And I'd never spoken to this guy because I was silent when we met. And I thought about it and immediately I was like, yeah, what I see every day is that people are good. I've just got this belief that everyone's good. And yet again, I saw it and I was like, this is incredible. But then I ended up thinking about it. And I was like, well, I'm not really sure this trip is about all those things that we're told are important, including money. You know, I don't think money is going to help me get closer to myself necessarily. So I ended up saying no. And we went for a dinner and he had a briefcase on the table. And I only assume there were like blocks of gold in there.
But, I'm wondering what he's buying from you.
Exactly. So, no, it was, and he got really upset when I said no, because he's such a nice guy. And I told him that, what I just mentioned to you. And, we remain good friends. He paid for dinner.
How old? At least he paid for the dinner. Yeah. How old were you at the time?
So that would have been a year. So I left on my 28th birthday at the end of 2009. So I would have been I actually have a feeling it might have been in the first 6 months of traveling. So I think I was 29, 28.
Yeah, I mean, I totally get the why you said no, and I think it's admirable, and I think it was a really smart decision. But for a 28, 29-year-old guy, doesn't have a huge amount of cash, has all these adventures that he wants to live out, it would be very easy to create justification in your mind to say yes to that. And I think good on you for the willpower to realizing there was a bigger thing at play.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, yeah, it just didn't feel right. We are told, aren't we, from a young age that, you know, financial security is paramount, and from that, and only when that's achieved, can you start thinking about yourself. Hence, you know, retire at 65 and then go on a holiday, which is an extreme thing, but way of looking at it. But yeah, I don't agree. I think, you know, many of the important – I've got a tattoo on my back, which is on my list, and it says – it's from The Little Prince, a French kids book, and it says it's in French, but in English the translation is, one can only truly see with the heart. The essential things are invisible to the eyes. And I've never referenced that in my life, by the way. I feel like a bit of an idiot having done it. But it is apt, because I do think that, yeah, the invisible things, they're the important things, the things we can't touch. And you can touch money, and therefore I don't think it should be. Because I also think it's so abundantly available. It's everywhere, money. You know, a lot of people have money. Some people don't have money. And in the same way that, you know, I think that, I don't know, I think it comes and goes. And I think it comes if you're living on purpose. And I think that's the best way to do it. And even though it would have made sense, it wouldn't have offended anyone, and I would have been able to tick off lots of things on my list because of that offer. I'm stoked I did. And I mean, even I got a Facebook message from a lady last week, and I only remembered to reply to her today. She wants to remain nameless. She just said, hey, again, because I do a bunch of helping people now, right? And she said, I'd like to donate $1,000 just so you can help someone else out, a complete stranger. And I said, I tried to contact her, call her, and she didn't want to chat. She just said, I just want to give you the money to do whatever you think is good with it. And what's interesting is I'm not a charity. I'm not a non-for-profit. I'm technically for-profit, not that there's, you know, profit really abundantly splashing around everywhere. But, yeah, it's just people want to be good. People are willing to just give $1,000 just so somebody can help somebody else. Someone's willing to give a briefcase full of gold bullion because someone's passionate about something. Money's never been the thing.
Yeah, but this is what I've always believed, that everyone everyone wants to contribute in some kind of way, and everyone has different things at their disposal in which they can contribute with. So, you know, you've got your ideas people, you've got people who can implement things, you've got connectors, and then you've got people who have cash where they may not have the time or their energy or the creativity to create something, but that is their offering.
Yep.
And I think the platform that you've created, and I definitely want to talk about KindSum, you know, moving forward, is you're letting people with diversity of skill sets and interests come together and all play their role without judgment, and realizing that everything, whatever they have, is of service.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. We all want to be seen. We all want to be feeling like we can contribute to something. And yeah, like you say, some people do it financially. Some people do it through a talent. Some people do it through giving time or energy. Yeah, it's a million different ways to do it. I agree. It's really well put.
I want to talk about the idea of connection, because obviously, you know, you had so many people who reached out to you through the journey of the 100, your personal 100 things that played a role in you being able to, you know, fulfill these dream items for you. Like, how did connection and play something in that entire experience?
Well, it's all connection. You know, I realized when my friend passed away that, you know, the idea of connecting with others is great. Community is fantastic, obviously, but I just never connected with myself. That was it. So once I started to, by way of my list, it was just incredible what happened. And, you know, this very beautiful community has blossomed out of nowhere. And it turns out, of course, that I'm not the only person with a list. We all have them. We all have at least one goal, whether you're an individual or a family or a business or a country. You know, we all have goals. That's how we're wired. And yeah, because I was sort of just kind of blazing my own trail without any care of where it ended up, other people sort of, I don't know, joined and got involved. And it was either through helping or they'd start their own list. And of course, 100 Things then turned into this big community of people, like-minded people. And by doing that, I was able to, yeah, I found that I had my oxygen mask on suddenly, and I just felt in a position where I could just sort of start helping other people in various ways and sort of pay back the favor in a way. And yeah, I think you know this story, but you know, the first person I ever helped directly was a guy called Mark, who was a quadriplegic. And he wasn't always that way. He got bitten by a tick and got Lyme's disease. And he wanted to complete a half marathon, and he asked me to push him. And I said yes. So I pushed him in a half marathon. And it was, you know, I'm not saying this for effect. It was one of the greatest things I've ever done in my life. I'm so proud to have done that. And the interesting thing about that particular thing was it wasn't just me who pushed him. Even though there was only a few of us who started, by the end of it, there was like 10 or 15 people who had pushed him the entire way. More people finished the race with him than started. And it's just abundantly clear to me that we just want to be kind. We crave connection. It's such an important thing. In this time of isolation, everyone wants it still. Of course, Zoom's popular. Of course, we do these video conferencing calls. And of course, everyone's starting podcasts and, you know, myself included. We all want to connect. We all want to connect. We all want to be seen. We all want to see other people and contribute. So I just keep seeing that over and over again. And of course, the onflow of helping Mark is that I've been really fortunate to help lots of people. It even got turned into a TV show over here. I never speak about this. And I don't know if you know, if you knew that. I've got this reality show over here. Did you know that?
I read it in your bio. Oh, yeah, I read it in your bio. And when we spoke about 2 years ago and we were going to do this, we were going to be on a roadshow and talk together. I remember you telling me, and I never saw it because it didn't come out in Australia, but How did that come to life?
Well, even that was weird. I mean, there's never been a plan with this, which is I love. And I was just speaking on a stage in LA, and afterwards this guy who ran a production company said, "Hey, we want to make a TV show about you. What could it be?" And I said, "Oh, I think it could be something to do with kindness. I'd love to help people." And he's like, "Great, let's do it." So then I flew back to Sydney, essentially forgot that we had this conversation, because I get a ton of different kind of offers. It's quite overwhelming. And then a year later, I went back to the same conference, bumped into him, and he said, "What happened?" And I was like, "What do you mean? He's like, we want to make a show with you." And so that time we sat down and we agreed to do it. So it was a reality show that was put on a platform called Go90, which has since been like absorbed into a bigger thing. And yeah, it was a show, 26 episodes. I got to help 26 people all through the US and Europe. And oh my God, that was an experience. I mean, just, you know, being flashing the light on why I did this in the first place, just to kind of have an experience. And I was flown around America with a production crew, never done anything TV-wise in my life, and helping people. I couldn't think of anything more fun. And I was living in Australia back then, so I was just flying back and forth to, you know, for 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time. And then we ended up in Europe helping more people. And things we did on that show were incredible, incredible. Oh, gosh.
Well, what's some of the things, what's one of the acts of kindness that you did for someone?
Well, there were less acts of kindness. They were helping people achieve things on their list. So it wasn't sort of necessitated by a story of need or someone who deserved. It was just, you know, what's interesting. And so from a creative point of view, it wasn't quite what I was wanting to do, but it was still fun. So, you know, for example, I met a guy who had isolated himself in his house in LA, and because he was scared of like the world. And he, I guess his escapism was via video games. So his favorite game was a car racing game where his favorite track was the Spa de Francorchamps, which is the Belgian F1 track. And this particular game, he used to race a Nissan GTR around it, right? So we set this all up. He had no idea. I went and played him in this game, in his, like, you know, dungeon, in his dungeon of a bedroom. And at the end, and this is, you know, obviously being pre-planned, but he had no idea, I said, "Hey, do you want to fly to the actual F1 track in Belgium and race an actual Nissan GTR around an actual track?" And he said yes. So we did. It was that kind of thing. It was epic. It was really fun.
And he just Did it? He straight away did it?
Yeah, we did. I mean, yeah, well, the magic of TV is that, yes, we absolutely did it then and there. But no, I mean, it was about a month later. But, you know, another girl always had a dream of singing opera and in a opera theatre, but she was always too scared. And we heard she had an amazing voice and we saw clips and she was phenomenal. So we flew to Strasbourg in France and we went into this beautiful old, I guess it's like the Strasbourg Opera Theatre, and it was completely empty and it was like a two-tier type of auditorium thing with, you know, red velvet seats, and it was something magical about it being empty. And she got all dressed up in some operatic gown and a crown and sang this song and, you know, this the operatic thing. It's very high-pitched. And I was the only person in the audience, and this was, of course, like the finale of this show, and it was amazing. I cried, actually.
Yeah, well, talking of crying and even going back to Mark's story, I cried watching that, and I actually wrote down what he said afterwards. He goes, "At the end, I felt alive. It was magical." And I can completely understand why that was transformational for you, for someone to have had an experience with you that took them to that place where they felt they could be fully with themselves and alive and magical and human and capable. And I guess that's where I feel like your driving force now is. You know, you experience things for yourself to develop on a personal and physical and let's say maybe even spiritual level. And it's brought you now to how can that now affect other people, and how can I be the conduit, one, through the platform that you've created. But you were doing, like, so to give people context, like, you had a website, people would put their lists on there, and then you would kind of connect people up to try and fulfill the things on their list. And a lot of those were in the adventure space, weren't they?
Yeah, there was a bunch of that stuff. So, like, you know, I saw that a lot of Australians wanted to do the Kokoda Trek, and I thought, why aren't they doing it? They just need an opportunity, maybe. So I said, hey, I'm going to go to Kokoda. I've got 15 free spots available. Not free, sorry, but 15 spots available. Who wants to come with me? And within a day, 15 people signed up. So we all went. Yeah, so we've done 8 trips now. We've done that. We've done Machu Picchu. We did an Indian wellbeing retreat. We went to Cambodia volunteering. Went to Antarctica, Kilimanjaro, Everest Base Camp.
Sorry, how did your platform build up to a place where you created this community? Was it the corporate speaking? I mean, social media was really in its infancy at the beginning of the time that you were doing this. So how did it build the life that it now has?
My platform's tiny, really. I mean, in comparison, you know, I've got friends here in LA who have millions of followers. One of my friends has 6 million followers on Instagram, and she's beautiful, and that doesn't hurt. But yeah, no, I've got nothing. I have 10,000 people or something like that. So I just have an engaged community. I just have a community. I'm very fortunate. Like, it's just full of good people.
Well, I want you to talk about that, because I think people get lulled into thinking that, like, the quantity is what's critical to create change and effective change at that. But can you shed some light on how a, you know, relatively small but powerfully engaged group is all you need?
Oh, yeah. Well, we had – it is, of course. The other stuff doesn't matter. We've been in isolation. We've been throwing these surprise virtual birthday parties for strangers, because there are people in isolation who are alone on their birthdays. So Toddy, who I'm working with, came up with this idea. Why don't we throw these parties? And I was like, great idea. Let's do it. So the other day, we've been doing heaps of them, but the other day we threw a surprise birthday party for a lady turning 99 years old, and her son, who reached out to us, said, do you think we can get 99 people to turn up? And we said, yeah, let's try. And we had 100. So 100 strangers from around the world, from some 4 or 5 different continents, all tuned in to surprise this lady. And we sang happy birthday, had a dance. So, yeah, it's just, I don't know, we just need to connect authentically. There's so much, there are a lot of facades and masks that people wear right now. And, you know, there's an illusion that, you know, numbers, like you say, is the important thing. And it's not. It's not. You've got to start with yourself and then just be yourself. And then the rest works out, you know, whether you've got 2 followers, 100, 1,000, or 1,000,000. That's the least important thing. You know, that's a byproduct.
And you're not selling people, you know, something. You're helping them create purpose, which I think is what you did through the list itself. And let's chat about, like, the evolution of Seb, you know, yourself. You know, the list, you said, obviously has changed now. I can only really see one thing on the list that's created to, like, family. Number 35, find my family tree.
Mm.
If you were to make your list again, like, would there be more personal endeavors in there?
Yeah, such a cool question. So Toddy and I have been looking at my list lately, and because for years people say, what's next on your list? And I what I have said for quite a while now is, well, you know, I thought it would take me 100 things to get happy. And I realized, having now done 74 things, that it was actually number 26, help a stranger, where my happiness lay. And it sounds great. It's very poetic. And you know, and it's true. It's what I absolutely believed back then. But a couple of years on now, I realize that of course helping people is great. But you need to maintain momentum on your own things as well. Like, it's a balance. You know, people are either self-centered or, and this is a generalization, but either self-centered or selfless, and either one by itself is not good. You need to be a balance. So we recently, going back to your question, looked at the remaining 26 items on my list, because I've done 74 now, I think. And I'm looking at which ones I still really want to do and light me up inside, and which ones are sort of, they just represent an older version of me. And so we've got it on a work board to actually go through them. And I want to sail across an ocean still. That's been on there for 10 years. I still want to do that, but not by myself. I want to do it with a bunch of other people who want to learn how to sail and cross an ocean. And so there is this sense more of a communal feel to all these things now. My family tree is interesting. I kind of started with my sister in Ireland at the beginning 2 years ago. But even that, and I guess this brings up another point, if you've just got to be really honest, it doesn't really intrigue me anymore for some reason. I don't know why. It just doesn't intrigue me. And again, it sort of highlights the point that you shouldn't just do the things you're expected to do because you don't want to let other people down. It would be lovely to say, yeah, Sam, and you know, now I just really want to get to know my extended family and really burrow in and find out where we came. I don't care. I just don't think that's important. And other people do, and that's fine, but I'm just being honest, you know.
And I'll tell you how else that connects. You know, when you go to a city and, you know, people feel like they have to tick off certain things when they visit that city because that's what it means to go to that new place.
Mm.
But if it doesn't light you up, like, why are you wasting your time literally just ticking off something off the list to say, I went to Venice, Italy that way and experienced that place? True. I mean, that's kind of like, that's what a bucket list kind of represents to me in that form, that we're ticking things off to kind of feel fulfilled, as opposed to the idea that your list is, how am I evolving as a human? And if my evolution changes to a place that no longer is relevant to me, well, it's my choice to change it and then do something which now continues to fulfill me.
Yeah. Yeah. We all have an opportunity if we wake up in the morning. You know, that's, we just do. It's never too late. Because we're completely in control of our lives, and you can choose to live any way you want. It's the beauty of life. And you can choose to do it so that you, you realize how accountable you are, and you can make choices that align with your values, that better you as a person, or you can choose to ignore it. And again, I'm not sitting in an ivory tower saying all you people should, not at all, but it's, you know, that's just the truth of it. So this process of kind of looking into the list and what the remaining 26 items, which ones change, which ones stay, what are the new ones that come on board, you know, that's all right ahead of me. So it's kind of funny, you know, I give these speeches about how to create your list that's meaningful and relevant, and workshops and all these things. And I'm right in the middle of it now again. I'm no different, and no one is, you know, in the same way. You know, I'm not special. You're not. We're all the same. Or in fact, I should say I am special, but so are you, and so is everyone, whichever way you want to put it. The point is we're all the same. And I'm right in the middle of that. And also I wanted to say this earlier. When I pushed Mark, it was testament to that too. We're the same. That wasn't a charity case where I helped someone and he was a recipient of kindness. He achieved a goal, and he did so by being proactive and asking someone who said yes. So we both won. So there's not, there's again, it's a bit of a misconception that there are people on this planet who are kind and there are people who receive kindness, and that's it. And it's not that. It's both ways all the time.
Well, can you tell me a bit about Kind Summit and where you are in that journey? And I'd love to know, in the Kind Summit journey, do people get to contribute? Like, is each person contributing something, or is it just acts of kindness given onto someone?
Well, again, it's awesome. So for people who don't know, Kind Summit is basically, what happened is I ended up helping quite a few people, but I couldn't help everyone because I'm just one person. And I wasn't sure how to fix that. So a lot of other people started getting in touch and asking, hey, do you know anyone we can help? So I would say, yeah, I do actually. So I started manually matchmaking strangers to engage in acts of kindness. So then I thought, well, I could automate that process and create a site, and that's what Kindsome is, which is essentially almost like an online, it works with the same dynamic as an online dating site, but instead of love, you go there to help people or ask for help. So the concept's awesome. I love it. And there's been there have been lives saved. There's been, you know, I mean, the stories are endless, but it's in its infancy. But equally, so that's what Kindsome is. It's based on the premise that we all have kindness. We just don't know how to direct it. We just need an opportunity. And so it's really an opportunity website. But I'm starting to wonder whether it's actually really that different to 100 Things and whether they should be two different brands. You know, I kind of see that kindness, like I've been saying, isn't just one thing you just choose to do. It's the end part of the spear. That process of putting oxygen masks on other people is not, you don't just, you know, if I just helped Mark 10, 11 years ago when I started my journey, it wouldn't have meant anything to me. It meant something when I found myself. And that's a bigger process. So yeah, where and what Kindsome looks like in the short term, I'm not sure, but the premise is beautiful and it allows people to be good.
Well, yeah, and even in the 100 Things, when you're connecting people to do things together, kindness comes out of connection. So if, you know, a whole bunch of people, 15 people are going to go and do the Kokoda track, there'd be a shitload of acts of kindness that people are bestowing upon each other because they're in connection with each other.
Of course. I did the Kokoda trek something like 8 years ago, and I was on the phone to Patty, one of the guys who came on that first trip. He's been on 3 trips in total now. And he's just an act of kindness. I'm about to launch an online workshop, how to create and, you know, execute your list, basically. And he's allowing me to do that on his platform, which is his business, which is, you know, like a work platform for training and what have you. So, yeah, it just exists. It's just, you know, we're in this wonderful world full of other people who, just like us, dream and aspire to do things. And if we take it upon ourselves to go, you know what, I'm just as important as anyone else, I need to do that, not only will you better yourself, but you'll be better placed to help other people. And that's the beauty of living.
Well, I've heard from a lot of corporate clients, but also other speakers, how incredible your keynote is, but also how it leaves a lot of pennies dropped afterwards and kind of almost shakes people up to really question themselves. And being in the corporate speaking game, I know how that must play a role with some of the clients that might book you to speak. And have you got any like stories of, because I have them myself, like of clients going, okay, so you've been a corporate lawyer and now you're running around the world and you're doing social impact. Like, we don't want our, you know, staff to leave and be a runner after you speak. So there's obviously other themes beyond that. And I'm like, you know, it's you've got to find your thing. I'm not saying you're going to be an endurance runner. Do you have a bit of the same sentiment that kind of rolls out?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, not all the time, but I do get, I just signed with a speaking agency here in the US, and that one of their concerns was, well, hang on, why, what's to stop the people you talk to just leaving their business immediately? And it's joked about a lot, right? But that's not my message. My message isn't, you know, this is the misconception again. It's not rat race or work versus having fun. It's all under the same umbrella. You can find purpose in your professional life within a micro role, within the macro, you know, premise of your whole, whatever it is your particular industry is doing, in the same way that going out and going, you know, for a long run or climbing a mountain or flying a plane or playing guitar or marrying someone or having children, it's the same thing. So I'm not suggesting anyone drops their job to go and do something. My only suggestion is, hey, give yourself a moment to consider what you're doing, how you're doing it, because ultimately that's the thing. My list has got nothing to do with, you know, it's weird. I'm sort of, you know, put on a pedestal because I've achieved things from my list. My list is just a vehicle for me to try and be closer to, you know, try and find out who I am, basically. And if I'm able to do that and I feel I'm getting closer, I think the challenge then is just to try and be yourself. And I think if you can just be yourself, if everyone can be themselves in every aspect of their life, from home to when you're alone to when you're with friends to when you're at work to what you do with your work, that's the key. So thankfully, and I can say this, with all the clients who do end up booking me, the feedback is out. The individuals or the teams or our organization, we're fired up. We've realized things that can really light us up and drive progress, and as opposed to everyone's left. I've never had that, which is lucky. I also feel like I haven't come across this, I sort of came across this once. There was a I was going to do a talk for a client in Australia, and I can't remember who it was, but they at the last minute said no. And it was all booked and stuff and paid. And they said, no, we don't want you to come. We've had a change of mind because we don't want everyone to leave. We don't want everyone to sort of do the things that they want to do. They put it in a certain way that was quite odd. And I remember thinking, like, imagine if you were a parent and, you know, and your employees, let's pretend they're your kids. What a selfish viewpoint to go, well, I don't want the light to be switched on in their heads. I'd rather sort of just keep them under control by keeping them in the dark. And I just, do you know what I mean? I just thought,
100%. And the light switched on doesn't mean people are going to leave, you know, necessarily. What it also means is they're just going to make sure that they find fulfillment and connection and purpose in what they choose to do.
Yeah, imagine being on your deathbed and looking back at life and going, oh, I wish I did that differently. And that's, you know, I think if everyone just had a moment to think about that, and if they do think, oh, my God, I would do different things differently, what would that be? And whatever the answer is to that, go and do it.
Well, are you finding some beauty in this time where you're actually in the one place? Because you live a quite a transient, traveller, vagabond lifestyle. Mm. What's kind of some of the takeaways from you kind of through, you know, the lockdown, the somewhat social isolation that we've got everyone experiencing?
Is a vagabond a tramp? Did you just call me a tramp? Is that what happened there?
Maybe, but I thought you might let me roll with it.
No, you're spot on. No, it's been great. I've been a really diligent, community member over here. Toddy and I have been working every day. We haven't been going out. The beach is only just, I surf a lot. I surf most days, but I haven't surfed for 2 months because the beaches here in LA have been closed. And I would have thought beforehand, oh my God, this is going to affect me. And it hasn't at all. We've been working and been so creative. We've developed a, you know, the game Cornhole? You know that game?
No.
It's an American backyard game. It's basically a plank of wood that has a hole in it, and you throw beanbags to try and get it in the hole is essentially what it is. It's ridiculous. And we've created the Corona Cup Cornhole Series, and we had a wooden salad bowl in the cupboard, and we weren't going to use it again. We don't believe in salads, so we used it. We kind of fashioned it into a trophy. So we engraved it, and it's a trophy. So, I mean, and so look, with work, staying healthy, and this Corona Cup, it's been simple and beautiful. And equally, I mean, I think that stands to another point, which is we think that we have to be out climbing mountains or skydiving or doing all these things externally to be feeling good. I mean, ultimately, that's, you know, that's it. We all just want to feel good. But you can absolutely funnel all your values, which are, again, the fundamentals for a meaningful list. If you understand what your values are, you can change and funnel goals that allow you to do stuff from home too. You know, you see all these people playing music on their balconies for their neighbors, or painting a fence with their kids, or learning to cook, or learning any number of online options to study things. There is so much you can do at home if you understand what your values are. And so in or out of isolation, there's no excuse to be feeling great. Unless you've got corona, then that obviously that's horrible.
Yeah, I actually just got my test results back last night. I'm corona free, everyone. Yay. But it took 6 days to get the results. And the only reason I did the test is because my toddler had a sniffly nose after 2 days back at daycare, and they wanted him to get tested. And I was like, as if a 2-year-old's going to have that thing put down his nose. So,
oh, God, is that what it does? Does it go all the way up your nose?
Oh, yeah, they put like a and it used to be worse. They used to do the 2-prong down both nostrils, all the way back down your nose. And I was like trying to meditate through it. And as the swab was hitting the back of, you know, as far back as you can go, the lady was like, oh, I think that's as far as it goes. And in my head, trying to not break the meditation, I'm like, so you think?
Wow.
You think that's as far back? Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I had a few little. I mean, really, it's not that bad. It goes very quickly. So if anyone obviously has to get it, it's a quick process to have it. But it took 6 days for me to find out that I didn't have it. Mm. And I feel like that's been the most stressful that I've been the entire COVID time on a personal level. And it's just that uncertainty and kind of knowing that I didn't have it because I've been in isolation, but the guilt of I can't see my mom, I can't grab my coffee, I can't do anything because potentially I don't want to put anyone else at risk. So I feel like this time is a bit of a wave, and it's like letting go what we thought that we were going to do this year. You know, I was actually going to be in your American shores in June, running across the country on the American Discovery Trail.
Oh, sick.
And it was going to be sick but not sick because it's not happening. Because we don't know how long it's going to be till we can kind of travel over to the US. But you're right. Like, I'm going through exactly what you just said, that I don't need to be running up a mountain, across a country, through a desert to still be happy. I just have to get a little bit creative and rejig the different things that I can do at my disposal.
Completely. Yeah. Yeah, completely. What have you been doing for health? Because, I mean, obviously that's a big one for people, right? People want to stay healthy, and typically that's done in a gym or at a beach or out on the roads. Have you been doing stuff at home?
I live in a national park, so I'm very, very lucky.
I wonder whether you could get, off the back of all the amazing work you've done, is to get a bunch of people already over here in the US to run your trail on your behalf. And so people just end up doing it.
Yeah, you going to do a bunch of that for me?
Well, yeah, actually, Toddy, who I'm working with, who's behind me, he's got his earphones on so we can't hear, but he's on his list. He wants to run 10 kilometres in every state of the US. He's from England, which would be sick. And I wonder whether, like, that could somehow team up with you. And, yeah, I mean, I'd jump in.
I love that idea. We definitely have to grab yourself, Toddy and I, and take that offline because, you know, there was, like, this sense of loss that this thing I had been working for so long really is just completely unrealistic right now, in at least the form that it was going to be done in. You know, I have no idea of when I'm next going to be able to be in the States. But to be able to kind of revamp that idea and actually involve a whole lot more people, that excites me. So I'm going to think about that, but let's definitely have a chat later on. I'm having a look at your list right now, and number 57 is cross a desert, which you haven't done. Is this still something that's, you know, you're thinking of doing?
Interestingly, it's up for debate. We spoke about it last week. I'm not sure if it is. I think that might actually be one to get replaced, not because it wouldn't be phenomenal, but because I've done a lot of kind of, you know, expedition, adventure stuff, and I don't know if I'd want to do that still. What I thought about, the reason I think this is because I thought, imagine if I'm halfway through a desert, you know, on an awesome challenge, and then I go, why am I doing this again? It doesn't really suit me anymore. And I feel like that might happen. So I think I'm going to change it. I don't know to what yet. That's the process for me. But, yeah.
Can I give you one cool thing about what you may experience in the crossing of the desert?
Yeah, please.
So I've done deserts as kind of like the beginning of my like endurance career. And what I have loved about like running through deserts or walking through deserts is like the insignificance of yourself in contrast to the entire being of like landscape and nature.
Yeah.
And I've never felt the greater power than seeing like expansive, vast land and then, you know, the sun coming up at like 5 a.m. and this burnt orange line, like far in the distance over the sand dunes, start to emerge over the sky, and it entirely transforms your entire physical and then mental state.
Wow.
Because you see that burnt orange horizon from the black sky when you are this small being amongst vastness.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is, I hope you've written a book about that. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I haven't, but that's my thing of like why deserts and moving for such a long period of time. You know, not every desert is super long as well, but that's a cool thing that I've taken away from it.
Yeah, and I just to that resonates with me. The idea that we are not insignificant, but we're certainly not the most significant. I mean, this corona thing again, it makes us realize that we're not the superior beings that we think we are. You've got to work in alignment with everything, the environment, you know, like we're all just one. We all just share this planet, right? And I got that in Antarctica. We took a group trip to Antarctica. And my God, you're just like sailing past 16-mile-long icebergs. And I remember when we actually got onto like a polar cap. I think that's the word. I'm trying to sound like your mate Jonesy now. Is it a polar cap? I'll have to text you.
And, I'd be lost saying those words too.
Yeah, and there's just like, you know, leopard seals and orcas and penguins and, you know, and then we are like idiots, you know, getting off a boat wrapped, you know, in all the Gore-Tex and everything you can find. And then, you know, you're just standing there trying not to die. And then there's just, you know, a fleet of penguins just going, you know, the winds that just come out of the hill, everything you just said, but less red and more white and blue. It's great. So maybe I will do it. Yeah. Who knows? I'll let you know, though. I'll keep you posted.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can just follow your list. Also, I'll be like, cross, Sam, replaced with.
Yeah.
What I will say is, you know, please reach out to me if there is something that I can do to help you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Firstly, if it's with your own personal list, or if it's something that kind of crops up on someone else's list and you're like, oh, Sam has like talents and time for that kind of thing. So, I'm happy to be of service for you.
I appreciate it. And straight back at you, I'm so glad that we connected. It's really lovely to chat. And I really enjoyed this. You're a great interviewer, if that's the word.
Oh, please, I'm making it up on the way. I really am. But it becomes very easy when you have someone like you. And also I've followed your career and your story for, now I'm going to sound like one of those stalkers, for like 10 years, mate.
I'm flattered you know my name. Thank you.
Nah, it's been an absolute pleasure. And, hey, guys, there's a lot of things to, and I wrote the list of all the stuff that I think people should reach out for you. You've got a book which shows your bum. You've got an ESPN doco, which is what I watched last night. You've got the US-based reality TV show. And is the links to that on your website?
Yeah. All that stuff's on my site. So, if anyone wants to come and have a look, absolutely. If anyone wants to start a list, let me know. If anyone wants to be kind, get in touch. If anyone needs some kindness, let me know.
Yeah, I can't believe that you. I'm happy that you have a team now, because I can imagine the administration behind doing all that was extensive, and you made a good choice not being a solo operator for it all.
Yeah, no, it's great, and I've found again, Toddy can't hear me, so I can speak openly about this. He's brilliant. It's just interesting because we all have our skill, things we're good at, and things we're not good at, and you know, Toddy's got the same values as everything, 100 things and kindsome, but he's got a different skill set, and he fills all the gaps. That I leave. So, you know, more and more so, I guess, why am I saying this? I guess it's important to know we are the spark for sure for all our journeys, whatever it is, physical, business, whatever. But it takes others to really grow things and make it into something magical. So I feel we're right at the beginning of that journey. So, I'm stoked.
Well, I look forward to 100 Things podcast. Well, you've just launched the first episode, which is like almost the backstory behind, you know, your list coming to life, and more the stories of the people that played the role in making it happen.
We literally just launched 5 minutes before we started talking our second podcast, episode 2, which is the stranger I married in Las Vegas. I haven't spoken to her since we got married 11 years ago. Her name's Shivali. And we interviewed her, and it's hilarious.
You haven't spoken to her since you got married?
No.
Did you have to get annulled? The marriage annulled?
Yeah, it's a long story. It's all in the podcast.
I'm about to go to the podcast. That is the best segue that I've ever had. All right, guys, jump on Seb's podcast to find out what it was like to marry a stranger in Vegas and how he got out of that situation as well. Oh, mate, you're an absolute trooper. There is so much about that conversation that I really appreciate. What I love was that idea of the positive ripple effect that happens for you and for other people when you're actually doing things that you really care about. And whether you're lacking purpose or drive, or you're not, I think there's such great value in putting a list together. And Seb's right, I believe a really good starting place is identifying what your values are. So if Seb is listening to this conversation, I want to send my gratitude for coming onto the podcast. I just want to send my gratitude for everyone who is tuning in, whether it be your first time or you're a repeat listener. It actually really does mean the world to me. This is a new thing for me, and it's just nice to be investing my time into something that I feel is really meaningful and that I'm also growing through this process. In a few days, I'm going to release my conversation with Nick Butter. And this is unique, guys. At the age of 30, he became the first and the only person in the world to run a marathon in every country. That is 196 marathons in 196 countries. That endeavour required him to use 10 passports, go on 455 flights through 15 war zones. He was mugged twice. I mean, the insights from someone who has done something that no one in the world has also done, in the way that Nick is able to convey these, they're incredibly powerful. And given the state of, you know, travel right now, I can't imagine that someone's going to be able to do this anytime soon. Wow, I've just got myself a little bit pepped up from those two conversations in my mind. But I really hope that you are all happy and healthy wherever you are. You know, Seb really landed on something beautiful when he said that we can find happiness wherever we are with whatever the circumstances are that are around us. But it does require us to be creative and connect with our values. Tuning out. Thanks, guys.